actually affect actual human people, human beings. So I have something of a slideshow with bells and whistles to show you. But I also want to make this as much of a Q&A and discussion as possible. So feel free to raise your hand, break in, ask questions at any time you like. So let me first tell you my story of how I ended up here in this room with the devices that I had. So as Professor Rita mentioned, I was born deaf due to an epidemic of rubella. My mother caught rubella when she was pregnant with me. So I was born with severe hearing losses in both ears. I had lost enough hearing so that I couldn't hear speech. That was why, when I was about 3 years old, I was not yet speaking. So my parents were concerned. They took me to the doctors. The doctor said, "The kid's fine. He'll start talking when he wants to." Well, they were, of course, completely wrong. What I needed was hearing aids, which I got when I was 3 and a half. And that was when I began my life as a language-oriented person. That was when I began to acquire English and to grow up speaking English. So with hearing aids, I was a person with a hearing loss. I could hear, but I couldn't hear that well. I missed things, I misheard things, but nonetheless, I went to regular school along with my peers. So that was the way my life went until 2001, when I was 36 years old. I was on a business trip in Reno, Nevada. I was standing outside Enterprise rent-a-car station. I was waiting for my car to be driven up, and I was wearing two hearing aids. And all of a sudden, the traffic on the road suddenly sounded very dim and faint, as if the road was suddenly much further away. And I thought, gee, that's funny. My batteries must have just died. Which is odd, because hearing aid batteries don't die immediately. They die very, very slowly. So it was just very odd that all of a sudden things sounded much softer. So I put a new battery in my left hearing aid. Now, my left ear is the ear that counts. Both of my ears are deaf, but the right ear is much deafer than the left ear. So my left ear is always the ear that I use for the telephone, for the radio, and so forth. The right ear just gave me a sense of directionality. So it was the right ear that seems like the batteries were dying. So I changed the battery. That didn't help. No difference. So I thought, gee, that's odd. Maybe it's the hearing aid. So I tried switching my hearing aids. This aid into that ear, this aid into that ear. Well, that didn't help either. So it was then that it dawned on me that it was not a hearing aid problem, that it was my ears that were dying. So I took my rented car that was being driven up, and I got in and I drove to the emergency room, where I was told that I was losing my hearing, which I already knew. I got cochlear implants 3 months later. And that was what began my journey as someone whose life is very intimately intertwined with neurotechnology. So for the first part of my talk, I want to talk about cochlear implants, just to give you a sense of what the technology is, how it works, and what things sound like to me. So let's go through a few slides that I call Cochlear Implant 101. But anyway, these are the two books that Professor Marina mentioned that I had written. So this book was my memoir. And I believe you may have read the first chapter of this. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, oh, great. All right, so then you know my story. Okay. And then that's the second book. And this is the book where I generalize from my concrete experience here to ask, what are the larger implications of neurotechnology for human society? But for now, I want to focus on this material. I also have written a number of articles on this, as Dr. Marino mentioned. So this was a story I published in Wired a couple months ago about prosthetic arms, about the fact that it's really much more difficult to build a prosthetic arm than the hype would make you think. So I really delved into what are the issues of trying to do this. And that has been one major aspect of my career, of doing what I call telling the truth about neurotechnology, about trying to move people away from these science fictional fantasies and assumptions about what technology can do, to talk about what it actually can do and what it can't do. So let me start with Cochlear Implant 101. Let me first ask, how many of you know somebody who has a cochlear implant? Can you do anybody else? Actually, a couple of people. That's really interesting. Who do you know, if I can ask?
The child of a neighbor.
Child of a neighbor. Okay. How old?
I guess he's now 10.
Mm-hmm.
Do you talk with the child?
Yes.
Yeah. What's his hearing seem like?
It seems pretty good, although not what I would call normal.
Mm-hmm. That's about how I would describe my hearing. Pretty good, but not normal. Well, I mentioned that actually a bunch of you raise hands. I usually only get one or two people raising hands. But anyway, let me go through cochlear implant 101. Let me start talking about how normal your works, just to give you that background. Sound goes in through the ear canal and hits the eardrum. That motion is transmitted through three tiny bones to the cochlea, the inner ear. The cochlea is a hollow tube filled with about 12,500 tiny hairs. Each hair is the size of a cell. It sits on top of a cell. And as sound waves sweep through the cochlea, the tiny hairs inside the cochlea vibrate, and they vibrate to specific frequencies. Some hairs at the very base of the cochlea resonate to the high frequencies. The ones at the apex of the cochlea resonate to low frequencies. So the cochlea takes sound frequencies apart, kind of like the way a coin bank will sort coins rolling down through the sides of the slots. So that's the way normal hearing works. When those hair cells resonate to sound, they trigger nerve endings, and those nerves bundle together to a trunk line, the auditory nerve that goes to the brain. So the cochlea is really the heart of the system. The cochlea is what translates sound vibrations into nerve impulses, that is, into electrical signals that then go to the brain. The reason that I am deaf is because I am missing most of the hair cells inside my cochlea. That's the reason that most people are deaf. It's the cause of about 95% of deafness, damage to the hair cells. The nerves are completely intact. You may have heard the phrase nerve deafness. That's actually a very outmoded phrase. We now know that only a small fraction of deafness is caused by actual damage to the auditory nerve. The vast majority of cases of deafness are caused by damage to the hair cells inside the cochlea. Since the nerves are intact, what that means is that you can run a bunch of electrodes inside the inner ear, and you can actually see the electrodes here. And then if you send electrical pulses to them, that will force the auditory nerves, which are here, to actually fire, and that will send sound information to the brain. That's the heart of what a cochlear implant does. Those implanted electrodes send electrical pulses and force the nerves to fire. So let's work our way back out and talk about what's outside the cochlea. So outside of the electrode array, there is a wire that goes to the top of the skull, and it goes through a tunnel that is dug through the bone by a surgeon when the surgeon installs the cochlear implant array. So the surgeon drills a hole from the bone and runs this wire through that hole and pokes it into the cochlea and spirals the electrode array 1 3/4 turns into the cochlea. Then here, on the surface of the skull, underneath the skin, you have the receiver of the device. That is what picks up signals from the headpiece, which is this thing that you can see sticking on the back of my head. So you may or may not know how the headpiece sticks there, but the answer is it simply sticks there magnetically, like that. So right now it is actually operating. There's no on-off switch. The way you turn off the processor is just by taking out the battery. So this is the outside of the system. This is the sound processor. This here is a microphone, and you can see that it actually points backward. That's because it takes the sound wave that bounces off the inner shell of the ear. It's a very clever system. It's as if you cut your ear. So this picks up sound. This unit, which actually has 6 separate computers in it, processes the sound and converts it into a string of ones and zeros, digital information. It sends those ones and zeros to this, the headpiece, which is a radio transmitter. And that sends a signal by radio through the skin to the implant. The implant picks up those signals and decides which electrodes in the electrode array to fire. So when I hear a high-pitched sound, like, for example, that's a relatively high-pitched sound. When my implant picks that up, it will convey that sound to my inner ear. I found most of the electrodes up at the base of the cochlea, which covers the high frequency sounds. When I hear my own voice, which is a relatively low frequency sound, that is encoded by firing electrodes all the way to the top of the electrode array. So basically, the electrode array tries to replicate the function of the nervous system inside the cochlea. So that's cochlear implant 101. Any questions about the technology? Okay, yes, sir.
How specific are the electrodes in firing there? Like, it's going 1.75 turn around, but how close is it approximating where you said there's like 12,000 pixels, or like how many points along there can actually?
Okay, good question. There are 16 electrodes in the electrode array in my particular implant. There are other brands that have 22 or 24 electrodes. The surprising thing is the number of electrodes does not seem to make much difference in how well patients hear. It actually makes no difference in when you look at an aggregate of patients. So the specific number is not that important. But your question is, how do you substitute the 12,500 hair cells with just 16 electrodes? Well, part of the answer is that you aren't. Okay? So when one electrode fires, like say this one all the way at the end, it will trigger a group of neurons rather than a single hair cell. So basically, each hair cell inside the cochlea resonates with one specific frequency. So that means that your ears, assuming that you have a normal hearing, have terrific frequency discrimination. You can distinguish between tones that are only a few cycles per second apart. I can't. That's because the system is much cruder, it's much broader than a normal ear. When one electrode fires, it makes a whole bunch of neurons fire instead of just a small and select number. And I will show you a sound demonstration. I can show you that loss of frequency discrimination that you get and what that sounds like. So the safety question is, you don't fully replicate the ear, the function of the ear. You simulate it. And it's not as good a simulation as you get in the lung. But it's good enough, and that's the point of the main one. Any other questions at this point? Yes.
This had never occurred to me until the last 30 seconds. Is there any more challenge to learn a natural language for someone who has a cochlear implant?
In terms of acquiring natural language?
Acquiring, because there are some languages, like Chinese, for example, some Chinese dialects are very subtle with respect to the melody, the tone.
The tonal languages.
Yeah. Is that a particular challenge?
That's a pretty interesting question. I don't know that the answer in detail, but it has been researched. So from what I understand is that children in China who get cochlear implants do extremely well. So they get enough frequency information to get the tonal information that they need. They can still hear enough of those pitch differences. In addition, language is very contextual. So even if they miss a particular word because they're not getting the tone, they can still reconstruct that word from the context. So, but there has been some research. I went to a conference on cochlear implants in 2005, and there were a number of surgeons there from China, and this was the question they were asking. So I know there has been interest in creating software that's specifically developed for tonal languages, but I don't know whether that software has been validated or whether it actually helps or not. But I do know this has been an issue of some concern. Any other questions? I thought I saw somebody else's hand up. Yes.
In the case of getting, let's say, a sinus infection or infections, does a cochlear implant, is it affected because of the infection within the sinus cavity?
That's a great question. I've had sinus infections, okay. So I can answer that question directly. Okay, I just realized the answer is more complicated than I thought, but theoretically the answer is no, okay. Because when you get a sinus infection, you basically get inflammation in the eustachian canal, and that can fill up the middle ear, which changes the conductance in the middle ear bones. So that's one reason why a sinus infection will mess up your hearing. But as you're probably seeing, the system simply bypasses this entire system. In my ear, I have these conductive bones, I have an eardrum. These things are all still working. It's just that there are no hair cells to pick up that signal. So, in theory, my hearing should be completely unaffected by a cold, okay? In practice, it's a little harder to tell, because when you have a cold, you're kind of miserable anyway, and that changes your attentional capacities. But things don't sound different to me when I have a cold. I just have not personally noticed that. I did notice, though, in the first couple of years after I got the implant, I was feeling dizzy. Nobody knows exactly why I went deaf in 4 hours on July 7, 2001, but it certainly affected my balance system. Okay, because the balance system is right here. Okay, these two systems are very adjacent. I did notice that when I felt unusually dizzy, I also was not hearing as well. And actually, nobody was ever able to give me a satisfactory answer to that question. So in theory, hearing should be completely unaffected by the condition of the body. In practice, I think it's a little more complicated. Yes?
Just in general, with the less frequency, I guess, you can hear, can you recognize voices? Is it good enough to be able to recognize different voices?
Yes, I can. So when somebody calls me on the telephone, if it's a close relative of mine, like my dad or my mom, I will recognize their voices. And I can hear the difference between male and female voices. If you ever read the rest of my book, and you go to chapter 4, you'll find out that when it was first activated, at first I could not hear the difference between male and female voices, which was extremely disconcerting, as you might expect. But my brain learned how to decode that signal. I do get some frequency information. That's enough to help me hear the difference in pitches between different voices. So where to describe it? Well, we'll wait for that for the auditory simulation, and then we'll talk about that. Well, now, let me show you a cochlear implant. This is what a cochlear implant looks like once the surgery has been finished, but before the skin has been sutured up over the skull. And that's the slide I love to show to people just before at mealtime. I really like the slide for a couple of reasons. First of all, this is a real neurotechnology. It's a real cyborg technology. But it's not some clean antiseptic thing. Okay, this is blood and metal and bone. Okay, so you can see here, this is the tunnel that the surgeon drills to get to the inner ear. And so this is the electrode ray that is going down through that tunnel. The outer ear would be around here. The ear canal would be somewhere around here. The body of the device itself is exactly where you see my headpiece, because the headpiece sticks to the device. Now, I have one long actual set of cochlear implants to show you. So I'll pass this around so that you can take a look. So this is the actual cochlear implant that I have in my left ear. This is the one that I have in my right ear. They look very different, don't they? The electronics are actually identical. What is different is the packaging. Because I have this device, that thing, in my head, and because it has EMACA inside it, that means that I can't have an MRI. Because an MRI device would pull that magnet around. That's a big issue. So the next generation of this device was redesigned so that the magnet could be removed like that. So if the patient needs to have an MRI, to make a little slit, take the magnet out, do the MRI, put the magnet back in, and then just suture up the skin over it. The electronics are the same. The electrode array is the same. So I'll pass this around so that you can take a look at it. So another thing I like about the device is that there's actually some printing on it. It says Advanced Bionics, Clarion Platinum Series, Model AB5100H, this side out. Now, some surgeons must have put it in wrong. And you can see that, it's a little bit symmetrical. But of course, the reason it's this side out is so the magnet will stick to the headpiece. If you put it in the opposite way, the magnet will fly off of the headpiece. So it really is important to get it this side in. If you could open up this casing, this is what the internal electronics look like. So when I first saw this, when I was at the audiologist's office, she handed me one of these things with the casing off. And I held it in my hand, and I thought, oh my God, it really is a computer. Because you can see there are chips, resistors, and micro contacts, and all sorts of whatnot. It's a miniature circuit board. So I thought, oh my God, this really is going to go in my body, and it is somehow going to replace what my ears used to do. So it really is very much an electronic device. Any more questions at this point?
Yes. So you've upgraded somewhat the one implant. Was that a difficult, I mean, is it an invasive, again, it's an invasive procedure, is it a difficult procedure to undergo every time you want to upgrade?
What's the surgery like?
Surgery. Yeah.
Okay. The surgery itself is very easy. So for the first device, the surgical time was about an hour and a half. For the second device, it was only 41 minutes. And they were both outpatient surgeries. And when in the morning, I was home by the afternoon. So the surgery itself is not a big deal. It used to be. Surgeries used to be much longer.
Do you have to calibrate them while you're in? Is there a way to do that, to sort of tune them up?
Well, once you activate the device, then you do have to go through a lengthy calibration and training process. So once the surgeon finishes it, the patient will not hear until the processor is put on and programmed. So when the patient wakes up from surgery, they're just as deaf as they were before. They only start to hear when they go to the audiologist a couple of weeks later after healing has taken place. That's when you get the processor. And the audiologist has to do a couple of things. One thing the audiologist has to do is to decide how much current to deliver to each electrode. Okay. Because different people require different amounts of electrical amperage delivered to the nerves in that area. And different parts of the cochlea will be happy with different levels of current. So the amount of current delivered is very unique to each person. So that has to be carefully fitted to the person. And there are many other variables that have to be adjusted as well. It's funny because just this morning, I was at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, and my audiologist was adjusting my software. And so I just went through this process this morning. So I go back about once a year now to do fine tuning, to tweak things a little bit. In my case, for example, for reasons which are still not really understood, I just did not like the current coming into the top two electrodes. It was just a very low-pitched sound, and it actually made it harder for me here instead of easier. So at some point, we just turned those two electrodes off. So I'm actually using only 14 of the 16 electrodes in my array. So for some reason, those electrodes were interfering with the other electrodes, and turning them off actually helped. So that kind of comes back to what I said to you. The actual number of electrodes is not the most important factor. So there is that lengthy process of fitting into the person. And then the brain has to learn how to understand the signals that come from the device. But I'll get to that in a moment. Okay, so now let me give you an idea of what a cochlear implant sounds like to its user. And yes, did you have a question?
I just asked, at what age should they install it in a child? Kids, child deformed or deafness?
At what age can a child get a cochlear implant? 6 months old babies get cochlear implants. The earlier the better. Yeah, this went back to Professor Marino's question. So when a child is born deaf, the sooner they get usable hearing, the better their brains will mature to use a spoken language. So the earlier the better.
And then when they require changes as they grow?
Well, the funny thing is, okay, so come back, you would think, right, that a device that you installed 6 months, that you would think that something bad would happen as the kid's skull grows. But there's two things. The cochlea is one of the parts of the human body whose size does not change at all. So the electrode array will stay in the same place. This, the thickness of the skull will change, but the surgeon puts in a little bit of slack, so that as the skull thickens, the array just a little bit of the slack gets taken up. So the implant is engineered to last the lifetime of the user. So in theory, what's in my head should last a minute, until the end of my life. Yes.
Do the implants ever get infected as a foreign body?
Well, that's a huge issue in engineering these devices. So you want to make them biocompatible. Okay. There are a number of things that do go wrong. Sometimes people will get infections. And those are not directly related to the device itself. It's just that some foreign body was introduced in or comes up through the eustachian canal. The body just has a difficult time dealing with the presence of that foreign object. So occasionally, if the device does have to be removed and a new one implanted, that's relatively rare. What has also happened on rare occasions is that the device leaks. Blood and body fluids leak into the casing. So the thing about a cochlear implant is it's got to be very hermetically sealed. so that stuff doesn't get in there and short out the electronics. So when they are closing the case, they put it in a chamber that has krypton gas at 3 atmospheres of pressure. So the implant, even as you're passing around, it's got a gas implant at 3 times atmospheric pressure. So if there is a leak, it's more likely to leak out rather than leak in, or at least will greatly delay or leak coming in. So it's actually designed to actually push out so the stuff doesn't get in. So it does happen occasionally that the device will break. In that case, it's something you move and you know it was put in. Yes?
Are the electrodes secured in place in any way, or is it just the actual implant part that's secured?
Okay. So the implant itself, yes, it is secured. You don't really see that in this drawing. You know, it makes you think the thing just slide around, right? But of course, you see here that the surgeon drills a hole in the bone and sutures it down with steel threads. As the implant array itself, what happens is that basically scar tissue forms inside the cochlea. Well, what actually happens is the inner ear spins a sheet of proteins around the electrode array. And so the inside of the cochlea gets filled up with a sheet of proteins. And that holds the electrode array in place. The surgeon will also anchor it by putting in little bits of tissue here, basically create a plug around the outside. That will seal into place, and that holds the electrode array firmly. I've never heard of an electrode array moving around inside the ear.
And because of that buildup of protein and tissue, can it be replaced easily?
Yes, as a matter of fact. When you pull out, I've actually talked with surgeons about this, when you pull out the electrode array, that sheath will stay open. And not for a long time, it will collapse within a minute or so, but it will stay open, and you just slide the new electrode array into place inside that sheath. So it's very practical. You see the hand up? Yes.
How is it powered?
Power. Okay, great question. Where's the battery? The battery is on the processor. Okay. So the processor itself is charged by the battery, which is a rechargeable battery. But how are the internal electronics powered and the electrode array? The answer is the radio signal. So the radio signal delivers data to the implant, but it also delivers power. Because the electrical antenna inside the device, as it picks up the radio signal, it generates electricity from that signal. And that's what runs the chips. So it's radio frequency induction. Okay, let's go into the simulation. So for this, I want to give you an inkling of what I hear. And let me explain the pieces of this. So the word channel, in a very simplified way, just means the number of electrodes. It's more complicated than that. But for now, let's just say that a channel is equal to an electrode. My device is 16 electrodes, and so there is a type of software that plays 16 channels. It will take all the frequencies of the world, and will break it up into 16 frequency bands, and deliver each of those bands to each electrode in the array. Okay? The very early research electrodes had a single electrode, just one electrode. So it was taking all the frequencies in the world and delivering that to a single place inside the cochlea. So, say, right here. As you might expect, you lose a lot of frequency resolution when you do that. So subsequent generations of trial cochlear implants increased the number of electrodes. So there were, early on, there were 6 electrode arrays. So that's what one channel means. So I'm going to play you the simulation. It consists of an English sentence that has been electronically filtered to resemble the output of a cochlear implant. So your challenge will be to listen to that simulation and figure out what the sentence is. Okay? And I'll play it one channel at a time. So let's start with one channel. First of all, can everybody hear that? Okay. Can anybody understand it? All right, 2 channels. There's never been a 2-electrode cochlear implant, but we'll just take this step by step. Any takers? 4 channels. I'll do it again.
Michael Charest.
I am a jurist.
I'm a jurist, or I'm Michael Charest.
Well, it's not that which reads you, but it's not. It's not my last name. But you're hearing a sort of a shh or shh sound. Yeah. Okay, you're getting that. Anybody else want to guess? Yes.
I like to play chess.
I like to play chess. Okay, anybody else? Okay, let's go on to agent. You know, when my implant was first activated in 2001, the software gave me 8 channels of auditory information. Why 8 channels instead of 16? The reason is that for some, I don't know the actual reason, but it took each pair of electrodes and defined that as an auditory channel. So I'm taking the whole frequency band and dividing it up into blocks of 8. So this will give you some sense of what I heard that first day when I had my implant turned on. 8 channels.
I like to play chess.
Okay, who wants to hazard a guess? Yes.
Is it I like to play tennis?
I like to play chess.
Tennis.
Tennis. Okay, I like to play tennis. Anybody else? Let's play it again.
I like to play chess.
Okay, who thinks that I like to play tennis? Okay, who thinks that I like to play chess? Okay, let me give you 16 channels. You know, about a year after I got the implant in my left ear, I was upgraded to 16-channel software. And that was done just by uploading new software into the processor. If you take the battery off, you can see here there's a little electrical plug there. So the audiologist is plugged into that and uploads new software into the processor. And the processor then sends a subset of that software into the implant itself. So you can upgrade the software of a cochlear implant. There's no surgery involved. So this is what 16 channels sounds like.
I like to play tennis.
So it's pretty clear, right? It's I like to play tennis. So you now know that you were hearing something like jurist, you were hearing that tennis. And your guess, I like to play chess, was remarkably good. Very few people get anything at 4 channels. So you did quite well there. Chess, tennis, you know, so it's S's sounds. So you were not getting enough frequency information to really be able to resolve what the word actually was. And you can see at 16 channels, it's a lot easier. But now, to give you a sense of the difference between what I hear and what you hear, I'm going to play the unfiltered sound file.
I like to play tennis.
Big difference, right? Let's go back to 4 channels.
I like to play chess.
Can you hear it now that you know what it says?
I like to play chess.
Try 1 channel. Now, the funny thing is that even those 1 electro devices were actually very helpful to their users. Because if you're totally deaf, when you can still lip read, and you still have contextual information, even getting a very degraded signal is very useful. So even the early implants, which had only 6 electrodes, 8 electrodes, were actually very useful to the users. Now, big philosophical question, what does this sound like to me? What does a simulation of a cochlear implant sound like to a cochlear implant user? Okay. Now, I can tell you that what I hear is better than this. In other words, when I hear the original, I can hear the difference between this and this. I can hear how much smoother and more fine-grained this sounds. So I don't think that when I listen to the radio, I don't think it sounds quite as harsh and grating as this. And this sounds really harsh and dark even to me. And that's partly because my brain has learned to fill in some of that missing information. So I mentioned to you before that when I first had the device turned on, I could not distinguish between male and female voices. I was getting the frequency information, but my brain had not yet learned how to decode it. But also, there's a lot of missing information, because it's just not giving you all the frequency information that it would get even with hearing aids. So it took a while, but my brain learned how to fill in some of that missing information, just like the way the blind spot in the eye. The brain learns how to knit over that blind spot and fill it in so that you do not perceive a hole in your field of view, even though it is there. So that's part of that learning process that I went through. Yes?
Is there a big difference in the learning process in terms of someone like you, a period of your life where you did hear through like the normal cochlea and therefore has a lot of sounds and memories of things as a child, who just get this device for 6 months and then their entire auditory experience is only through this device. Is there a difference in how they learn things and their ability to fill things in like that?
It's a great question. One of the biggest predictors of success with the cochlear implant is how much you heard before. So a very young child will do very well with a cochlear implant, especially if they get it at a very young age, 6 months, a year. Because the brain is just, that's all they know. It's their reality. And their mind process is essentially identical to that of normally hearing children. You don't hear as well as normally hearing children, but they get enough information to be able to learn language in a way that is very close to normal. On the other hand, the implanted device is someone who's 40 years old and has never heard in their lives. The outcome is usually very poor. You rarely gain more than just an awareness of sound, which can be very valuable. Lots of parents will get it, because they need to hear their children crying. So even though they may be entirely in the sign of deaf world, they still realize when they have kids that they need to be able to hear. And so they get an implant without any expectation of being able to use the telephone or listen to the radio. But they do want to be able to hear the kid yelling, door knocking, door barking. So on those terms, it is a success.
Yes. How do you feel about deaf families and like having deaf kids and deciding for their kids not to get cochlear implants? Are you?
No, this is the whole big issue of neuroethics. So we'll get into this. I've got a slide about this. We'll defer that question to right now. Yes.
Just to follow up on the previous question. So what about, are there a lot of patients who had intact hearing before, lost it due to damage over time, and then got an implant? Is the learning process different for them, and are the outcomes different for them?
Generally, if a person has a normal hearing, and then they lose it, and get a cochlear implant, they usually do very well.
Okay.
Because they have a fully developed auditory cortex. Now, personally, I find it very hard to believe, but I've been told that they say that things sound normal to them. I can't fathom that, okay, because it is, you know, you've heard that 16-channel simulation. That's nowhere near as good as a normal hearing. But somehow, you know, they say that the brain fills in the... I can't explain it personally. But I've heard of people who get the device, they pick up the phone, and they call their parents, you know, which I couldn't do for 6 months. It took me 6 months to learn how to use the phone again. I used the phone with hearing aids all the time. When they got the implant, things sounded so bizarre. And it took me months to learn how to adapt to have different decision points. Part of the reason for that, by the way, let me go back to this diagram. In a normal ear, sound is sweeping through the cochlea. And so every hair cell will be activated all the time. So every hair cell is constantly being activated by sound sweeping up. So you have sound information coming through every part of the cochlea. You can't do that with an electrode array, because you're firing electrodes in a wet, salty environment. If you fire two at the same time, they'll short each other out. So the software designers fire only one electrode at any given instant. They just do it so fast that the user has the illusion that all the electrodes are firing all the time. The cycle rate is about 5,000 times per second. So it sounds like all the electrodes are being fired all the time, but they're not. Okay. So when this electrode, say, is being fired, this one isn't. Okay. So you get a very different pattern of nerve activity going to the brain. The information is there, but the brain doesn't know how to make use of it, or at least my brain didn't. So things sound completely bizarre to me. It was really shocking how awful it sounded. It took me months of learning before I could restore, before I got back to where I was with hearing aids. Okay, yes.
How does that work with being able to distinguish foreground and background noises, like in a restaurant, for example?
Hearing noise. So this is a big issue for hearing aid users and for cochlear implant users. Well, I've always found it difficult to hear background noise because I've never had normal hearing. But I seem to do pretty well with my cochlear implants. One reason is the design of the microphone. So because the microphone's like fitting into a cup, it has the effect of masking sound from behind me and preferring sound from in front of me. It works really very well. So that's one thing that helps. I find it easiest to talk with one person at a time in a very noisy situation. That actually worked extremely well because I'm only paying attention to one person, and they're usually talking more loudly because it's noisy. So So I actually do extremely well at parties. And I feel very grateful for that because lots of people don't. That's another interesting thing. So, yeah, the software can change. So about 6 months ago, I got new software which has noise suppression coding built into it. So that it's a very interesting effect. When I put the headpiece on, I'll hear background noise for about 1.5 seconds. And then all of a sudden, the background noise kind of goes away. So, like from running the bathroom sink, and the headpiece falls off, which happens, I put it back on, I'll hear, shh. So the software takes a second and a half and listens to what's going on, and it makes decisions about what's noise and what isn't, and then it tries to filter out the noise. So there are ways to try to compensate for that. So that's one thing you were doing in my audiologist this morning. You were tweaking the noise suppression algorithms to try to help me hear better in noise. So there are various solutions for that. Okay, yes.
I'm not really familiar with the neural mechanism, but does the shape of the microphone help you like sound localization? Like, can you tell very easily where a sound is coming from?
In theory, it should help. In my case, it doesn't. And this comes down to the point that every deaf person is different. Every deaf person is deaf in a different way. In my case, my left ear has always been the dominant ear. When I was growing up, I wore two hearing aids. I mean, my mother kept pointing out to me that my right hearing aid was turned off. I would just keep turning the thing off and forgetting about it. For some reason, the right ear has always been much worse than the left ear. So my brain has come to prefer the left ear. So I've always had difficulty combining the input from two ears. And that's how you can localize, by combining the input from two ears. But even though I have the same hardware, the same software on both sides, my left ear is still much better than my right ear. So I've really never gotten good at localizing sound, even with two devices. So when people call me, I would still, look all over the place to try to find me. Now, other people who get two cochlear implants, if they do it at the same time, which I did, I got them 7 years apart. And so partly that made me, because when I'm completely deaf, and when I lost my green ear, I had to rely on the cochlear implant. So my brain was forced to learn how to use it. But with the second one, I didn't really want to take the left device off and struggle for 6 months to make the right ear come up to speed. It would probably happen, but I just don't want to do that. So I'm happy to depend on my left ear. But one of the price I paid for that is I'm still not able to localize very well. But that just means that's my own unique history as a deaf person. Okay, well, I saw some other hands up. Yes.
At risk of sounding sort of glib here, I hope you don't take this the wrong way, but I'm curious, are there like other types of attachments that might work to access your, to connect up with that implant, such as maybe a phone or headphones or,
There are all sorts of attachments.
Really?
Yeah. Yes. So one attachment I could use, but I don't, is there is a way to take off the microphone, okay, and you put a special microphone on, which we plug directly into the output jack of an iPhone or a DVD player or whatever, that would allow sound to go directly from the device into this, so that you hear something that it ever existing as sound waves. Okay, I have that hardware. I just don't need it. Okay, I just put on headphones just like anybody else when I use Skype, for example. But for some people, that is very useful because it means they only hear what's coming from that device and nothing else around. Okay. So there's that. There's a bunch of other noise. Like there's an FM system where you have a radio transmitter that sort of looks like this. And you can give the radio transmitter to a lecturer. And so basically your ears are on their body. And so it makes it much easier for you to hear them because you're hearing their voice literally from the microphone. And I've thought about getting that, but I just don't have any big need for that either. So there are all sorts of assistive devices that you can get. Okay, let's move on. We'll come back to you. Okay, let's go on to a few more slides. And talk about neuroethics. So let's see. Okay, so I've already gone through this, how the software works. Okay, so we'll just pass briefly over this slide. But these electrodes simulate the code for high frequencies, these code for low frequencies. Okay, so let's start talking a little bit about some of the ethical issues involved in cochlear implants. First of all, is this a rare technology? Well, The latest data I have, as of 2010, is there's about 219,000 cochlear implant users in the world. Is that a lot or is that a little? Well, in this country alone, there are about 500,000 people with deafness severe enough to make them candidates for cochlear implants. Basically, you're not a candidate for a cochlear implant if a hearing aid can help you do what you need to do. Okay? So in this country alone, there's 500,000 people who could use this technology. In the world, I don't know how many deaf people are in the world. I don't know if anybody knows. But clearly, there are many fewer people, there are many more people who could use a cochlear implant than actually have them. There are all sorts of class issues, income issues, and nationality issues that factor into that discussion. Let me give you one example. So we're coming back to the deaf community. Thank you. So, in this country, we have a very heterogeneous health insurance system. A cochlear implant costs about $50,000, okay? $100,000 if you want to. Alright, so it's a lot of money. It's more than most people can afford out of pocket. But it has to be paid for by some outside agent. So, in my case, I had no trouble getting insurance approval for the first implant. For the second implant, I hadn't had a team of three lawyers. And we worked for a year and a half filing appeals against my insurance company to get them to pay for the other device. But they felt, or rather they argued, that the medical benefit of two was not worth the additional expense to them. Now, in my case, they were actually right. Okay? And I don't actually gain a whole lot of value in the second year. Okay? But many other people did get tremendous benefit in being able to localize, for example. They also get, simply hear better because they're getting more information for 2 years than for one. Okay. But in countries like Australia, okay, which have socialized medical systems, okay, in Australia, it is a government policy that every deaf child is an issue that goes to your plan. You know, 96% of deaf children are born to parents with normal hearing. So those parents don't know sign language. They've never learned sign language. They have no easy way of learning sign language, let alone it molding their kid, the environment where they will learn sign language. So when the doctor says to them, well, we've got this device that will allow your kid to grow up learning Australian English, the parents will say yes, in the vast majority of the time. What this means is that the sign language community in Australia is going extinct. And this is also happening in many of the European countries, especially Scandinavia, Norway, Denmark, where there are schools for the deaf, but there are simply no kids in the early grades. But all those kids who are being born are getting implants, and they're growing up in the hearing community rather than the sign and deaf community. So there are all sorts of issues here about cultural survival and language survival going on in various parts of the world.
Yes. I don't know if we spoke about it in this class or from somewhere else, but once you get a cochlear implant, schools for the deaf often consider you ineligible for the school. Was it here that we spoke about that? But so it's for the 6 months. You have the implant, but you don't turn it on. Is that, do you know if that's still policy of many deaf schools?
Hey, I'm not sure I understood the policy. Can you explain that again?
So my understanding is that if you're in a deaf school environment and you choose to leave that environment and get cochlear implants, it essentially makes you not deaf anymore. And so the schools no longer will accept you into the system. But for 6 months, you don't turn the system on, and so you still are deaf. And my understanding is the school policy is once you get the cochlear implant, you're betraying the system and you are no longer in that school. I don't know if you've heard of that or have thoughts about that.
The situation is extremely heterogeneous and complicated. Okay? There's no single policy I know of like that. Okay. Okay, I'm just trying to think of the right angle in which to discuss this subject. So, let me tell the story of how I got to Washington, D.C. Okay, that's going to be my entry into the subject. So I was living in San Francisco, and Gallaudet University in Washington, D.C. invited me to be a visiting professor on the Gallaudet campus for 9 months.
I don't know what that university
is. Okay, Gallaudet is the nation's university for the sign and deaf. So Gallaudet, the main language, the only language of instruction for sign language. So Gallaudet is very politically oriented toward deafness as culture. Okay. So it's So deafness is a very unique kind of disability in the sense that a whole culture has arisen around it because it has a language, as opposed to other disabilities like blindness, for example, losing a limb or something. And so different schools are culturally very different. So the Rochester Institute of Technology, which also has a large deaf school, is much more heterogeneous. Many of the students there consider the primary language to be English, a spoken language, but may or may know sign language. And so they are different in different classrooms, and they have different languages of instruction. So RIT is a much more heterogeneous policy about the language of instruction. And Gallaudet, which considers itself as being the sole bastion of higher education for the sign and deaf in this country. So it was quite a move for Gallaudet to invite me to spend a year here, because I'm oral deaf, which means that I never learned sign language while I was growing up. So I arrived on campus not knowing sign language. I didn't even know how to fingerspell. So it was a very great thing for them to do. It was a very great thing for me to do, okay? Because it's like going to Japan not knowing any Japanese and not having any interpreters. So in Gallaudet, it is sort of, Gallaudet is like a central example of this debate being played out. So 15 years ago, wearing an implant at Gallaudet would have been considered heretical. It would have gotten strong condemnation. That person would have been a social outcast. But now at Gallaudet, there are many students who have cochlear implants. So they consider themselves both hearing and deaf people. And they code switch, they shift back and forth between cultures as it suits them. So they would use sign in some situations and English in other situations. So a great deal has changed at Gallaudet in the past 15 years. So one of the really burning issues for Gallaudet and for other deaf communities around the country is, what is our future? What do we do? And Gallaudet really has not figured this out, as far as I can tell. So the enrollment has dropped significantly. It has dropped from something like 2,600 to about 1,600 in the past 10 years. And the question is, how much further does it drop before the government stops funding it? Gallaudet's a federally funded university. So the government pays for the entire university, which is unique in this country. So the question is, what happens to the sign deaf culture? What do we do? And I don't think anybody has a good answer for that. Yes?
To kind of answer your question, I talked to the CHOP implant team, and they said most kids aren't ostracized now if they have implants, but it's kind of the bonding experience, to echo kind of what you were saying, but they did say like a lot of the bullying and ostracizing has significantly decreased at like schools like Maryland, Penn School for the Deaf, and stuff. So it's not as bad as it was, say, in the 90s when the rhetoric was really rough and like incendiary. But she said it had reduced, and that kids with implants still didn't get to partake in that bonding experience of I can't hear at all and I'm part of the ASL community, and that is just natural. I mean, kids, especially younger ones, will congregate, and you can't really force them to accept someone who doesn't really, you know, speak their language if they're just learning ASL.
Okay, let's go on. So I was talking with you about the ethics of working with patients with neurotechnology. Okay, so I put this slide in. So let's just talk a little bit about what are the ethics of implanting a new and untried technology in a human being. So this is really a very interesting photograph. So this photograph is taken about 1972. So this is William House, who was working out in California. He was one of the pioneers of the earliest generation of cochlear implants. So he built one of the first single electrode cochlear implants. And then subsequently built implants with six electrodes, a six electrode implant. And that person there, Charles Greaser, who was one of the first users of Dr. House's devices. So they are posing here. So Greaser's holding his sound processor in one hand. And you can see that there's a wire going from the sound processor to, well, you can't really see what's back there. What is in his skull is a titanium plug, where that wire is running directly through his skull, and the wire is going into his cochlea and terminating inside there. So it's a direct wired connection from the outside of the body to the inside of the body. So there's actually a hole in the skin through which the wire is going. It's really hair-raising, okay? And at that time, the technology did not exist to create these wireless connections where the integrity of the body remains intact. So that was definitely Charles Green's ahead. Yeah, there's much less regulation at that time. I don't really know the detailed story behind this, but it's my understanding that Hatch didn't have to get approval from the FDA to create this device and implant it in the patient. He might have had to get local approval from the local hospital to do it, but there weren't those layers of bureaucracy and approval that companies have to go through today in order to use human subjects. Yeah, that's both good and bad, okay? It's good in the sense that you have much more rigorous oversight of this process. So you don't have people kind of on their own implanting these very risky devices in people who are desperate to hear again. But it's also problematic in the sense that the FDA regulations are so overwhelming that it takes a very long time for companies to develop new products. Because the testing process is so expensive that it takes a great deal of capital to try to build a new device. And that has a very real direct impact on my life. So these processors that I'm wearing, the design is 8 years old. So there are all these rumors of the company coming out with the new processors, which will have a lot of really neat new features. And I've been hearing these rumors for 2 or 3 years now, and nothing has happened. And part of the reason is the company is having to go through these very complex FDA sequences to satisfy the FDA that the device is both safe and effective. Of course, I don't argue with that. Of course, that's necessary. But a lot of people are arguing that the rules themselves have become antiquated, that they do not really capture the needs of people who are building technology now. So there are a lot of calls and discussions trying to reform these FDA processes to come up with a better balance between risk and development. And this is a big issue because not only are new processors taking a long time to develop, new implants really aren't being developed. So the fundamental design of the implant that I had was approved in 2001. Now it's 2012. I've heard absolutely nothing about a better internal device coming in. That doesn't mean that there isn't, but I'm fairly plugged in. I usually hear that something is going on. And this concerns me because it means that the companies are finding that process so expensive that they are being extremely slow about developing better cochlear implants. I think they're happy to ride with what they've got because they're making good money from it. So there are also economic and legal and social issues. They are layered on cochlear implants. Yes?
Is it one sole company that basically holds the patents on cochlear implants, or are there potentially even other companies that are now trying to put pressure to have those patents even expire so that there could be other generic or cheaper possible options?
It's a very good question. I don't really know the answer to the patent question, okay? I know that there are three companies in the world that make cochlear implants. And the core technology is pretty much the same. So I don't think there are any inherent patent issues. There's one interesting thing. I talked about the software, the way it flashes one electrode, it cycles very rapidly among the electrodes. That fundamental software was developed at Research Triangle Park, okay, mostly by one guy, a guy named Blake Wilson. And he and RIT placed that software in the public domain so that anybody can use it. And I think that's one of the unsung heroic acts of the cochlear implant world, because every cochlear implant uses that basic algorithm. If he had patented it, I don't know how things might have developed differently. Maybe one company would have bought that patent, the others might have had to try developing similar but not the same. I don't really know how that would have worked. But I do know that because he developed it, it certainly speeded up that software development process, because they could all take that methodology, which they knew worked, and build on top of that. So there are things that have gone on which have really not been adequately memorialized. You're really very smart and brave things to do. Yes?
The software update you said you got for the noise reduction, so those kind of things are being actively done, even though the hardware changes aren't being made, or are there software changes being made by the pharmaceutical companies that are doing that?
That's a very good point. That is true. There have been new generations of software. So let me talk about one of those. So I played through the simulation, 8-channel, 16-channel, and so forth. I had 16-channel software in 2004. In 2005, they got new software, which gave effectively 191 lectures. Now, how was that done? Well, you take two lectures and examine the currents so that you can steer the currents at very specific places in between those lectures, giving the user the illusion that there are virtual lectures in between the physical lectures. And in theory, you give the patient the illusion that there are 7 virtual lectures in between every pair of physical lectures. Okay. It's really neat. It really does work. I don't have a simulation of that to play for you. So, I got that software in 2005. It's called Fidelity 120. Okay. And the interesting thing is, it made music sound more natural to me, but actually made speech harder to understand. I'm still not completely sure why that is. It may partly because speech is very digital. The word tree is either tree or it's not. Okay. So in a sense, the simpler the signal is, the easier it is to understand. So for me, making the signal more complex actually reduced my word comprehension a little bit. Music did sound better because I got better frequency and simulation. So these kind of innovations are going on. However, I would not call those fundamental advances in the technology. Okay. The 16-channel simulation, if you heard what I hear with Fidelity 120, it would sound a lot more like the 16-channel simulation than like the normal hearing. Okay. It's still a lot closer to that 16-channel. So I would call it an incremental improvement. I would not call it a fundamental advance. And part of the problem comes right back to your question. You cannot fit more than about 16 or 22 lectures in there. Because the closer you put them, the more likely they are to short each other out, even if they're only being activated one at a time. If they're very, very close together, you still get that treatment shorting out. Okay? The fundamental problem is you can only go so far with electricity. And I get the strong feeling that the engineers have basically reached the limits of what you can do with electricity in your ear. So there's a lot of talk, and it's still just talk, about trying to replace the system with some kind of optogenetic or infrared system. Something that uses light instead of electricity. Because light doesn't, you don't get shorting out problems with light. And you can focus it very precisely with lenses. So there's a guy at Northwestern, for example, who's trying to develop an implant array that uses infrared light to stimulate neurons inside the patient. And he's getting very interesting results. So there is talk of creating a test electrode where one of the electrodes is infrared, is optical, all the rest are electrical, and implanting that in a person and seeing what that person can do with that optical electrode. So this kind of work is ongoing, but it's very slow. This is translational research, and it's a very difficult process. You have to evaluate in very, very tiny steps. So that's what I mean when I say that there isn't any fundamental advance. I think this technology is not as far as it can go. For the next generation, it's still just means you have to be as far as it can go. Okay, yes.
So your ideal in the future is to have cochlear implants that are mimic human voice, essentially, is what you're...
Better mimic the neural circuitry in your ear. So if you had an optical array that had maybe, say, several thousand light-emitting sources, and maybe lenses to focus them, then you could stimulate the individual neurons inside the cochlea. Or instead, with this, the best you can do is stimulate a patch of cochlea. That would be a real improvement in the state-of-the-art of the device.
Yes. I mean, I'm actually going to suggest, Mike, that you collect the questions, because I want to make sure you get through your whole talk.
Okay.
The time, and then
all right.
Just collect the response.
Okay. What time is it? How much more time do we have?
So about half an hour.
About half an hour left. Okay. All right. So let's go on. And there are a lot more interesting things to talk about. So let's talk about some of the stuff that you read in Mind Wars. Okay. So you thought about optogenetics. So I just want to show you an example of actually using this kind of neurotechnology so I can change behavior in a living creature. So, this. Can I ask somebody to just turn the lights off for a minute? Just easy to see in the dark. Thank you. So, you see a mouse that's in a basement. What you can see is a fiber optic cable that is coming down to a plug that is actually embedded in the mouse's skull. And that fiber optic cable is shining blue light into the mouse's skull. so that it illuminates the brain in a very specific wavelength of blue light. And a part of that message brain has been optogenetically modified so that when the light is shown on it, the neurons will actually fire. So we can actually use optical means to make neurons fire. I'll explain it again so you can understand what's going on. So in this mouse's brain, they altered the cells on one side of the brain in the motor cortex on that side, so that when the motor cortex was stimulated, the mouse's limbs would move only on one side of its body. Okay, so if you have four legs and only these two are moving, okay, you know what's going to happen, right? You're going to go in a circle. So that is what you see in this. So when the mouse is not being stimulated, so you see right now the mouse not being stimulated, it's doing its mousy things. And when the light turns on, the mouse suddenly starts to run the circle because its motor cortex is being forced to activate its arms and legs by optogenetic stimulation. When the light turns off, the mouse just stops. He looks up, what the heck just happened? Okay. So this is the kind of stuff that I explore in my second book. You turn the light back on and I'm thinking. So this is the kind of stuff I explore in my second book, Worldwide Mind. What are the ethical implications of this kind of technology? And I talked about some of these possibilities. So this is a Wired story that I wrote in 2009, I think. So this came out about 2 years ago, where I talked about optogenetics. I talked about some of the possibilities. The interesting thing for me about optogenetics is that you can actually make neurons fire, and you can stop them from firing. And because it's optical, you don't have that problem with electricity inside the brain. You can exert very specific control over the firing of individual neurons. So as you saw this mouse, you can make a brain do something that corresponds to a very specific action. So in this case, it was a mouse running around in a circle. But what if, in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, it's a specific thought or a specific sensation? And in theory, that should not be so different from a mouse running around in a circle, because fundamentally it's neural activity. Now, I don't want to be overly reductive. In fact, Jonathan talked about the issue of being overly reductive about the brain. The brain is not just a tiny switch. You can't just turn on switches and make a brain do something, because these neurons work together in very complex ways. So I don't want to oversimplify here, but it does open up the possibility that we can actually directly control what a brain does. What is that going to mean? And that is the territory of my second book, Worldwide Mind. So I want to come back a bit to deafness. And this point, I'll give you some facts and figures here, okay? To talk about the impact on the deaf community, there are a whole bunch of neuroethical issues involved in cochlear implants. So in 1995, in North Carolina, why North Carolina? Well, it's one of the few states that collects data on the educational modality of deaf children. Most states don't. North Carolina does. So North Carolina is not necessarily typical, but it is one story. So in 1995, 60% of the deaf children in the state were educated using sign language as their primary mode of instruction. 40% were educated mainstream using a spoken language. Well, 10 years later, you can see how much the situation had changed. 10 years, 85% of the students were using a spoken language as their primary school language, and only 15% were using American Sign Language. So that had a huge impact on ASL schools in North Carolina. Basically, they're consolidating and they're going out of business. Okay. So this is just North Carolina, but I know anecdotally that very similar things are happening elsewhere in the world. So, for example, so there's a paper that came out a couple of years ago in 2006 about the impact of cochlear implantation on the sign and deaf community. This was the conclusion: negative impact of the cochlear implant program on the future growth of the sign and deaf community in Australia must be deemed to be significant, irreversible, and well underway. So we are seeing real cultural changes. To put it another way, deaf people are the only people in the world right now whose lives are being directly and culturally impacted by neurotechnology on a social level, as opposed to just an individual level. Yes?
Do you know if there are any studies where they measure happiness among, communities of people that are in the signing community and then people that have COVID?
That's a great question. I don't know. That would be a really interesting research project. I've never heard of it being done. That would be a very, very interesting project. It would be complicated because you have to, there'd be so many potential confounding factors and you have to account for it. So, I'm just trying to search my mind how many confounding factors there are, and there are a lot. As I said before, only 96% of children in this country are born to hearing parents. Only 4% are born to culturally deaf signing parents, or rather, just deaf parents. Okay? So only 4% of deaf children grow up using American sign language. So, but you have another, there's another population which doesn't have access to culturally deaf parents because of socioeconomic issues. So they have very limited access to spoken language. And they learn sign language mostly by default if they really learn language at all. So that means that a significant portion of the sign deaf population in this country is significantly educationally and socioeconomically disadvantaged. So that's a huge confounding factor in terms of happiness, okay, and life satisfaction and educational achievement. So you have to figure out how to account for that kind of confounding factor. You also have to think about the fact that many mainstream children, they can hear just like I can hear, but they don't hear as well as normally hearing people. Okay. Also, they are often more socially isolated than people who are normally hearing. So even though they can hear, they may not have the same level of feeling of social integration and happiness that their hearing peers might have. So I'm an example of that. I was the only deaf kid in my school when growing up. It was very difficult for me to socialize. It wasn't just because of my hearing. It was also largely because I was really an incurable geek, okay? And I really mean it. I was just very, very peculiar-oriented and just not that social. But I think that my life would have been very different if I had normal hearing, because I would have been able to overhear things effortlessly. A lot of people learn by overhearing. I can hear, but I really can't overhear. Nor can I understand what somebody is saying. I have to really focus on it. I don't really just sort of hear conversations going on in the background. And that is how a lot of people learn about the social norms in the organization and the community. I really was not treated to that kind of learning when I was learning. So the fact that a kid is a cochlear implant doesn't automatically mean that they'd be happy. In fact, it may mitigate against their happiness. Okay. So I think it's a very complex process to undertake, but if you think about it, I'd say go for it. It would be very interesting. You try to control for all the different factors.
It's going to make me happier if we let Mike get through the talk for the next few minutes. Okay.
So let's go on.
I'm sorry,
Zolkin.
My happiness is all that counts.
Yeah. All right. Point well taken. Okay. I mean, I don't feel compelled to get through every slide. I mean, it's back and forth to me. Okay. So let me just talk a little bit about, the big questions. Will neurotechnology change the lives of non-disabled people? Okay. It's obviously having a huge impact on the deaf community. But what about the non-disabled? And I'm fairly skeptical about neurotechnology really changing the non-disabled. And let me talk a bit about why. Okay. So, there's the issue of pharmaceutical drugs. And this is very complicated. I know you guys have talked about this in class. And I'm not that knowledgeable on this topic, but I spent 10 days here at Penn taking Martha Farah's brain camp, which was absolutely wonderful. If you ever get the chance to take it, I recommend it. But she has done research trying to assess the effects of drugs like Provigil and so forth. And the evidence is very equivocal. Okay, it's really hard to say what is really happening in the brain. Is it a placebo effect? What is really going on? And to me, what this means is we really don't know how to change the brain in a targeted way. We can only flood it with chemicals, okay, and hope that something good happens and hope that the side effects are not too severe, okay? That's telling me that I'm getting low on time. And I can't really localize, so I don't know where my eye is. So I'm a little bit skeptical about pharmaceutical interventions being clearly effective, okay? devices are invasive. The risk-to-reward ratio has to be very favorable in order to consider having somebody operate on you and put something in your head. I was willing to let a surgeon drill into my head twice and put things in there because the downside of not hearing was enormous. I was willing to undertake that risk. But to do this, to enhance yourself, that's a whole different equation, okay? So if it ever become possible to use a technology like optogenetics or some kind of exotic kind of nanotechnology that we just don't have today, are people really going to be willing to have someone operate on their heads, on their brains, to change stuff? Well, the same question might have been asked of cosmetic surgery 100 years ago, okay? Now things like breast implants and tummy tucks and liposuction are routine. So the risk-to-reward ratio has obviously become favorable for a lot of people. But will this be so for the brain, for the seat of personality, for the organ that is the very essence of who we are? I'm very reluctant to give an unqualified yes to that answer, okay? A lot of hurdles would have to be overcome to make brain surgery safe, affordable, cheap, easy, okay? So I'm very skeptical of that, and that's why. As for external things, and I know you've also talked about things like functional MRI and so forth, the big issue here is you really need the cooperation of the user, okay? You really can't force somebody to tell you the truth by sticking them in fMRI. Because all they have to do is shake their head a little bit, and that will completely screw up the test. So you really need the willing cooperation of someone to find out what their brain is thinking. And there have been all sorts of fascinating functional MRI studies done of actually identifying correlating brain activity with the subject's internal experience. So there also is a fascinating research. But none of this seems to suggest that there's any real future of coercive uses of neurotechnology. I just don't see any of these kind of Dr. Strangelove kind of scenarios taking place. So yeah, this was kind of, this point was made in this interesting paper by James Giordano down at the Potomac Institute. Jonathan knows him. And so, he wrote this whole paper about neurotechnology, national intelligence defense. One of his basic points was, it's a lot smarter. think about cultural sensitivity, right? Instead of bombing people, learn how to make peace with them so that you don't need to try and develop all these exotic DARPA technologies. And so this one thing that I have most in mind when I write books and articles on neurotechnology to really point out that there are much more effective low-tech ways. Like, if you really want to enhance yourself, getting a lot of sleep, eating a healthy diet, there are the best ways to do it, instead of trying to load yourself up, with drugs and stuff like that. So I tend to be much more of a skeptic, which is a little bit odd, given that I'm a direct beneficiary of neurotechnology. Okay. But, of course, the reason is also obvious. I'm one of the very few people who are obviously directly affected by it. So I think that is a very unusual position. Okay, so wrapping up here, I just want to talk a little bit about the idea suggested in World Wide Mind, which is you could, in theory, and I think that this was the achievement of World Wide Mind, to take the idea of something that could be called mind control. And instead of talking about it in a sort of a science fictional vague kind of way, to actually try to spell out in conceptual terms how it could actually be done. I'm not aware of any other book before mine that actually tried to do that and got at least partway there. That's what I tried to do in World Wide Mind. Trying to show that with a technology like optogenetics, you can, in theory, okay, very much in theory, determine which electrons fire into somebody's brain when they see an apple, okay? And then send that signal for an apple to somebody else. Someone who has the same hardware, where that hardware knows which neurons fire in their brain when they see an apple and make those neurons fire. So, is this possible? Well, in a very distant theoretical sense, it may be possible. And I think just being able to say that isn't itself a big thing to do. So that's what I tried to do in World Wide Mind. It would be very difficult. Let me just briefly say why. There's been some very interesting studies done that show that when a mouse does something, certain neurons will fire. And then when the mouse does the very same thing again, 5 seconds later, different neurons fire. So it's really, really difficult to say that this group of 18 neurons is responsible for this particular action. Okay, the complexity of that relationship is still very much beyond our understanding. Our brains are not set up in that simple kind of way where if you make these 165 neurons fire, then you will think of an apple. It clearly doesn't work in a way that is that simple. But I think we are at a point where we can talk conceptually, theoretically about such a thing with a degree of precision. Precision is the wrong word. With a degree of groundedness in real science that really was just not possible 10 years ago. So we're at a very interesting inflection point where we can actually start to talk about this stuff in concrete ways instead of just fantasizing about it. So that's what I did in Worldwide Mind. Okay, well, that's the end of my talk. So thank you all for listening to so much for having.
I'm just wondering if there have been any neuroanatomical or neurophysiological studies of auditory cortex differentiating between device-enabled hearing and non-device-enabled.
It's a very interesting question. I wondered about this myself. Does my auditory cortex look like your auditory cochlear after 10 years of cochlear implantation? A lot of this depends on which level you're looking at. Okay, so I would guess on a gross anatomical level, probably on the auditory circuits are probably fairly similar. I mean, yeah, there are these maps, the auditory circuitry in the brain, and they are mind-boggling and complicated. Okay, you know, there's different parts of the brain that, you know, it's really complicated. But I would guess that on a gross level, my map probably looks a lot like your map. Okay, but when you get down to a much more granular level, maybe in terms of, you know, the way frequencies are processed, it might indeed be very different. Okay, and I think one argument in favor of that is the fact that it took me 6 months to learn how to use the phone again with my implant, which means that some very significant learning process had to go on in my auditory cortex, and that I could not use my cochlear implant until my brain had changed. So I guess on a granular level, there probably are differences. What they are, I don't know, but I think that would be very interesting. You know, I have asked people, what do we know about the brain because of cochlear implants that we didn't know before? And I really have never gotten a satisfactory answer to that question. And I get the feeling that this is not a highly researched subject. It just seems to me this is an area that's just crying out for all sorts of fascinating research to go on. I just may not know about it, but it seems to me, because it's such a well-controlled situation, okay, you could take someone who's normal hearing, you know, or maybe somebody who's a progressive loss, okay, evaluate the brain when they still have most of their hearing, then evaluate the brain in different stages after they get the implant, after 5 years, after 10 years. I bet you can learn a lot from doing that, but I'm not aware of that kind of research going on. I think it'd be fascinating if it exists.
One of the problems that I realized I wasn't smart enough to think of when I, even when I revised mine, was how to distinguish between technologies, enhancing technologies that are truly neurological and others that are simply somehow technical. But let me give an example. So Google is supposed to come out with their glasses, one lens of which, somebody on top of this more than I am, is going to basically put your computer screen in what looks like, I think it's 12 inches away, it will appear to you to be roughly a foot away, I think is what I meant. And that's imminent. And you'll be able to control it, I guess, with some kind of remote control device, like a mouse that will wirelessly connect. Maybe you'll be carrying it in your pocket, or you have it in your hand, and you'll be able to. Now, so, in the one sense, that's the same technology that we already have, just putting it on a little screen. Eventually, it'll be on a contact lens. And eventually, I suppose, you can actually have it bonded to your eye. implant. That's why you want to do that, but I guess you would. But here's the question. It's working on our sense perception, obviously, like my glasses are. But is it really a neurotechnology? And is, you know, is that just a matter of the practice of a conceptual practice and drawing distinctions that we haven't had to do yet? What do you think?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I mean, for me, and not that people would argue differently, but for me, the big issue is whether it goes inside the body or not. Okay, you know, so there's people like Andy Clark who have argued that people were all cyborgs because we all use these enabling technologies. Okay. And while, I mean, Andy Clark writes great books, but I've just never been fully convinced by that argument. Because it seems to me that unless it is actually directly connected to your nervous system, it's not really a neurotechnology, okay? So I don't really consider a sea leg a neurotechnology, yeah. Even though it is all sorts of computation, you know, in terms of the way it moves and so forth. But it's still, it's just a very sophisticated peg leg, okay? Unless it starts messing with the way your nerves work, to me it doesn't feel like a neurotechnology. Yeah. But this is debatable.
Yeah. I had a similar question because in a sense the implant isn't, you're stimulating the cells that are attached to the nervous system. You're not like wired right into the nervous system. And are there next generations of things that will literally be grafted onto the nerve, the auditory nerve or the optic nerve, let's say?
Well, let's talk about what it means to be grafted onto the nerve, because in a sense, I don't think neurotechnology either. Let me explain why. Yeah. Okay, so the electron array, all right, so here's the nerves, here's the electrodes, right? Certainly looks like a direct connection. In fact, it isn't, okay, because the cochlea is a bone structure, okay? So these electrodes are not actually touching the nerves. They're sitting, you know, they're separated from the nerves by a very, very thin layer of bone, okay? So even in my sense, even me, they're not grafted onto the nerves. They're just extremely close to the nerves. So, you know, so you see, it does get debatable.
That's just the question I was raising. Yeah. In this instance, they're not technically mm-hmm. attached to the nervous system.
Yeah.
But are there, mm-hmm. Maybe down the road, will we get to a point where we're just going to be one? You know,
well, these do exist. I mean, you're all doing things like deep brain stimulation for Parkinson's. So there you do put an electrode into the brain, and the neurons actually, the axons actually connect to the electrodes. That really is a direct interface. But there again, you say the optogenetics aren't that's really, because you're putting light sources, you know, inside the skull, and they're shining into the... You know, so it does get a little bit fuzzy. But it seems to me, though, that if you have to have surgery to get it...
Right, no, that's a big deal.
Yeah, you know, it's certainly psychologically, it's a much bigger deal if it's actually becomes a part of you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes?
In that sense, how do you feel about TMS and TDCS, like the non-invasive neurostimulation modalities that are out there? Do you see them playing a bigger role?
Yeah, you know, I know something about TMS, and so I know a lot about it. I think as far as I know, the jury is still out about what it really does to you. I mean, I've seen these papers where you zap people and they're suddenly 20% better at remembering words. You know, I think Jonathan discusses this in Mind Wars. I've heard the interesting story at MIT of, you know, people joking that they would sneak into the TMS room before their exams and zap themselves. Yeah. You know, it's hard for me to take it that seriously, because first, you've got to have this big machine, right? It's not that convenient of a cheat to use. Although you could build things that you can sit in your head and
they will.
Actually, in Worldwide Mind, I talked about my experience with a machine that uses P300 detection. So it's surprisingly effective. That's what it looks like. It looks like person sitting down, they've got this cap on, like a bathing cap, and it's got electrodes on it, okay, there's about 16 of them. They're sitting at the computer, they're not doing anything, and letters appear on the screen. So it really looks like the computer's reading the person's mind through the cap, okay? But then when you actually do it, you realize it's like learning to take it to a magic trick. What's actually happening is that the computer is flashing the letters of the alphabet rapidly on the screen so that each letter is lit up for a very brief time. Okay. And so if I'm going to spell out the word Mike, I mean, look at the ant, and we flip the light up. When it lights up, like, when it's where my visual cortex will activate, it will generate a P300. It's very loud, very clear, easy to see. And people will pick that up and figure out, okay, I saw P300 when I flashed the M. Okay, that means he doesn't want me to put an M on the screen. It's just the letter you're looking at. Because you look at the letters, you want to write. And it's actually amazingly effective. It works very well. So, when I saw it, like, oh my God, that's amazing, really being a person's mind. When I actually used it, I realized it's actually really very simple. Okay. So, things like TMS seem to sort of fall into that category of devices that do stuff to you and can tell what your brain is doing things, but I'm just not too sure how impressed to be by them. You know, if you walked in, having that system is a godsend. Yeah. I know there's talk of using systems like that, you know, to help pilots and things like that, but I haven't heard of those systems really becoming commercial reality and being used to team. At least I'm not aware of them.
Any other questions?
See, just one more question. Mm-hmm.
Do you consider yourself a transhumanist, and what is transhumanism?
Okay. I do not consider myself a transhumanist. So I've read the literature, you know, I've talked to people like subscribe to extra being and so forth. So transhumanism is a very strong eschatological aspect to it that I'm just not comfortable with. But have this kind of ideology that we would be able to perfect our bodies through technological means. But first, I'm skeptical of that, just on medical and physical ground alone. Okay? I don't deny that it could happen. It's just that nobody has shown me a clear engineering path to make it happen. In fact, actually, one book, as far as I know, the closest they were to come, it's actually spelling out as engineering path in colloquial terms. And even I would say, that's really, it's just a very vague kind of path, okay? So I think that the transhumanists are, they're really into existing technology much more than really can they do than read into it, okay? Basically, they are projecting into what they want to be true, rather than looking at what is true. So I'm really skeptical on that ground. And the second thing that makes me skeptical of it is that I feel like they want the technological magic fix, okay? So they want to find, you know, the magic implant that makes you smarter. And that, we have, and they're saying this in a world where we already have all these tools, but there's all sorts of socioeconomic factors which have been out of use. If you want to make people smarter, pay teachers more. So, you know, until we actually start doing those things, I just find it really hard to take seriously these technological fantasies that, to me, sort of feel like distractions from the important work we have to do as a society. You know, I'm not saying that that kind of research is not important. It is important. I'm just saying that to read these dreams into it and confidently predict them in public as uncommon realities, I think it's a big mistake. Yes.
In the next however many years, if the technology gets so good that eventually the cochlear implant hears just as a normal ear would, presumably then pharmaceutical companies could take the next step in some of the cochlear implant to hear better than a human being. So what would your thoughts be about elective cochlear implants in that case?
Well, first, you should probably know right now I'm deeply skeptical of that happening. Okay. Because we, as yet, know no mechanism. So you can say, you know, cochlear implant that lets you hear better than normal ears. You can say that in a sequence of English words. That does not take you anywhere near to actually create it. There is no engineering problem enough to create it. But to take the question as good as you ask it, if it was possible by some technology we can't imagine. Okay, so what is your question? The question is, would I think it would be a good idea to do?
If someone were to want to get the elective cochlear implant, someone who was a normal hearing person that decided, hey, I want to hear better from this advanced technology, mm-hmm. What would you think about that?
Okay. This is a good note to wrap up this class on. I mean, this class session, I'm not doing it. So,
there's no wrap up from me, so.
It almost always makes me say, imagine the future, it's like the present, only bigger. So you have people predicting, you know, back in the 50s, flying jetpacks, transportation is sort of like stuff we have now, only bigger, right? Faster cars, moon leases. What they didn't predict was all the stuff that actually did happen. Right? So if you had to ask me what the future of neurotechnology is, I would take the advice of creating devices whose job is not to enhance the body, which I think is difficult and risky, and not necessary. Let me explain this for you. The normally functioning human ear is incredibly sensitive. If you move the eardrum by the width of a hydrogen molecule, that will result in a perceptible sound. That's how sensitive the ear is. You can hear incredibly big things, a normal healthy ear. So, I mean, this is a big point that I made all my mind. If neurotechnologies do something, what they do, they will allow them to do things that are not possible now. And so that's what I'm considering this, and I could do things that we can't do now, create new kinds of futures. So what my mind, for example, imagines something which I call telepathy, where you might have implanted brain devices that allow people to broadcast what their feelings are, so that other people could be aware of what they are feeling at given moments during the day. And to allow communities to know collectively what everybody else in that community is feeling. Now, today, it sounds like a crazy thing. Who would want that? Why would anyone care? But that's only because we don't have a social context in which that kind of information is considered valuable. So there might be technologies that allow that to happen. So they might create ways for us to create kind of collective awareness, of which today, we don't even have the language to talk about. So what I think more than the answer, to me, that's what the answer is. Allowing people and communities to do things that they can't do now, to expand the universe of possibilities. To me, that's what's worth thinking about and talking about and working toward. And compared to something exciting like that, you just get the idea of saying you have to hear bats. Well, so what? You know, to me, that's just not an important or exciting thing to do.
Okay,
thank you.
Thank you very much. And the good news is there are going to be review sheets for you coming around.
Last week.
Exciting. And this is it. So I really enjoyed it. And I hope you're not too depressed that we can't enhance you as much as you know, you probably came into the class thinking we could. I've done my best. But, you know, I'm only human. Unlike Mike. See you.
So the review sheet is going to be sent around by Blackboard.
Thank you. And the folks who are coming to dinner, just give me a couple of minutes, and we'll meet right here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was really fun. Yeah, actually.